Welcome to the Black History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Nashad Carrington. Now, I know in past episodes, I've declared that we will try our best to steer clear of religion, and I know that by this point, we've broken that rule a few times. But, as always, in the event we do decide to cover the topic, we surely will stay as neutral as possible, and today, I promise you, is no different. Now, our staff chose to cover this individual today because of a number of factors. First, many have never heard of him, and he's an integral part of the religious life of the African diaspora, as his decision-making and influence now has been felt across the globe. Now, secondly, we love to profile and cover bold, outspoken, unafraid people here, and our subject today most certainly was both of those. And that you'll see as we kind of go through. And third, he was a friend, at least for a time, to Marcus Garvey. And while I didn't know Garvey, obviously I'm under the age of 100, from all that I know about him, for you to really make it into his inner circle of, you know, his circle of friendship and also the inner circle of the movement, the Pan-African movement, you really had no choice but to be prolific and championing the cause of Black liberation. So our topic for today, he really met some criteria to get around our aversion to promoting any one religion, which we won't do either way. And as such, we'll present him in the same light as we would any other religious figure. Really and truly as objective as possible, and really to not offend or detract from our overall purpose or your listening pleasure. Now, as always, in the event you do not share the same religious beliefs as the person we're profiling, we would just ask that you at least walk into this experience with an open mind and open heart to receive the history lesson, as again, we will not be providing religious lessons. Also, this may be one of our shortest episodes in the series, but I can promise you that we won't skimp on the information we pack in. More than anything, as the topic is religious-based, we really just want to kind of cut back on a lot of the extra commentary and really just kind of present the facts as they are. So, with all of that said, here we go. George Alexander McGuire was born on March 26, 1866, at Sweets, Antigua, in the Caribbean West Indies. As a child, he studied in local grammar schools on the island and then continued on at the Antiguan branch of Miko College for teachers and eventually at the Moravian Miski Seminary in the Danish West Indies. Now, specifically, he was at Niski St. Thomas in the West Indies, and he graduated probably around 1888. We don't have that for certain, but more than likely it was around 1888. He served as a pastor first at a Moravian church. He did that at a couple of different churches. We won't get into the details of the title and where, but Moravian churches is where he got his start. Now, McGuire's father belonged to the Anglican Church in Antigua, and as such, McGuire was baptized into that denomination as well. For several years after, as we said, McGuire actually pastored a Moravian congregation at Frederickstad, St. Croix. He was just moving all over the West Indies. But when he came to the United States in 1894, he chose to be confirmed in the Protestant Episcopal Church. For 4 years, McGuire would serve as an assistant to Dr. Henry L. Phillips, who was a prominent pastor of the Church of the Crucifixion in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He was ordained as a deacon in the same church on June 29, 1896, and then as a priest the following year. And he was then sent to his first parish assignment, which was St. Andrew's Church of Cincinnati, Ohio in 1898. At the beginning of his career, McGuire led small, mostly Black Episcopal churches in Cincinnati, Richmond, Virginia, and Philadelphia. Now, from 1905 to 1909, McGuire actually served as the archdeacon for colored work in Arkansas, where he passionately worked to increase the number of missions from 1 to 9. Now, that's a lot of missions, and that's a lot of work to be doing in 4 years. Now, while he was involved with the Arkansas diocese, McGuire wrote a crucial addendum to a book entitled, quote, "The Crucial Race Question, or Where and How Shall the Color Line Be Drawn?" End quote. In this piece, McGuire revealed publicly for the first time not only his eloquent and learned style, but also the pride of race that characterized his life and the way in which he taught. Now, McGuire would reflect in this piece that the Episcopal Church's record of dealing with race issues left a good bit to be desired, and that the affairs of segregation within the sect were so bad that publicly and privately, but more importantly publicly, both Black Methodists and Black Baptists would openly refer to the Episcopal Church as, quote, a black body with a white head, end quote. Now, McGuire further insisted that due to the pride and race that they had, they must inquire and request for Negro bishops. Now, this might seem a little bit contradictory, but in it as well, McGuire insisted that there were no instances, regardless of the decisions made of the Episcopal Church's hierarchy, that would induce or convince him to leave the Anglican communion, but instead that a movement of separation might result in the event no affirmative actions were taken. In this, he as well wrote in pertinent part that
the crucial hour is upon us. 10 million Afro-Americans await anxiously the result of the test. The church cannot afford to treat us in beautiful generalizations any longer. Will she rise supremely to the opportunity and duty of the hour? And considering racial differences, prejudices, and peculiarities, relieve her Negro clergy and people of much embarrassment and supply them with the entire machinery for doing successful work among their own race without becoming schematics or asking for an autonomous ecclesiosa in ecclesia.
Now, the church failed to respond to his impassioned writing, which almost amounted to an ultimatum. And of course, many will say, well, I don't negotiate with terrorists. Well, maybe the church viewed McGuire that way. And McGuire realized that an independent organization of independent episcopacy was not going to work and was not going to happen. He left this position after serving for only 4 years. At the time, his reputation was as a fiery and articulate spokesman. That preceded him to his move to Boston, and he was called to be the first rector of a black congregation that had actually just separated itself from a white-controlled St. Peter's and had now formed the new St. Bartholomew's Parish in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just north of Boston. He would lead this congregation from 1909 to 1911. Now, the congregation at St. Bartholomew's was primarily West Indians in the Boston area, so I'm sure he likely felt right at home. Now, while in Cambridge, McGuire also took this opportunity to study at Boston College of Physicians and Surgeons and received his medical degree in 1910. After this, McGuire actually moved to New York City to work as a field secretary for the American Church Institute for Negroes. He would serve in this post for 2 years before returning to his home country of Antigua in 1913. Now, there's a little bit of debate as to what actually encouraged McGuire to go back to Antigua, and very little evidence to support any decision, but it suggested that the decision to return came in large part because he caught glimpse of the dilapidated condition of the Church of St. Paul's. But what likely originally sent him back there was to take care of his sick mother. Now, the Church of St. Paul's held a very special position in his heart, as this was actually the church that he was baptized in. Now, he would serve at St. Paul's for the next 6 years. He was consecrated as a bishop on September 28, 1921 in Chicago, Illinois, by Joseph Rene Velate, the Metropolitan Archbishop for the Archdiocese of America of the Syrian Church of Antioch. That's a mouthful. Now, after this, McGuire assumed the title of Alexander I, Primate of the African Orthodox Church. Velate's religious background and consecration itself were a little bit suspicious, but his credentials satisfied McGuire and would strongly impress the priests of the African Orthodox Church in South Africa. Time out. Flag on the play. So right here, we might get on a little bit of a side of confusion. There were two African Orthodox churches. One was founded in South Africa. The other was founded in the United States by McGuire. So let's touch on this African Orthodox Church founding. So we're going to start with the one in South Africa just to keep you together with where the story's going, all right? So the African Orthodox Church was founded in South Africa in 1924 by priests from the Independent African Church. These priests were dissatisfied with the administration of the African church and believed that they could establish and run an independent church for Black Christians that would actually be more responsive to their own needs and to the needs of their parishioners. One of the priests in this group was Daniel William Alexander, who had superior leadership abilities. At the very same meeting in which these priests decided to resign from the African church and to form their own independent church, they also elected Alexander to the position of bishop. Now, as we'll go through this bit, please don't confuse Daniel William Alexander for George Alexander McGuire. They are two separate men, but they had two very similar missions. Now, unbeknownst to those of the African Orthodox Church in South Africa, a church in America by the same name and same goals had actually been established in 1921 by George Alexander McGuire, our topic for the day. The McGuire African Orthodox Church was originally called the Independent Episcopal Church. Now, at its first meeting of the House of Bishops on September 10, 1924, the name was changed to the African Orthodox Church. McGuire was unanimously elected to be Archbishop of this new church and enthroned with the title Archbishop Alexander. As we ever so briefly touched on prior, McGuire's experience in the Episcopal Church had been tainted with incidents of discrimination against himself and fellow Black clergy. Now remember back to his call for more Black leaders of the church and more bishops that went unheeded by the church. So he severed ties with the church and decided that only in a denomination of Blacks with a Black administration would equality and spiritual freedom really be attained. And he said to go along with this, quote, "The white churches in America had drawn a circle to exclude people of color. Our vision is to draw a wider circle that will include all people," end quote. At its inception, the African Orthodox Church took strides to establish ecclesiastical and spiritual freedom for Blacks and people of color. The African Orthodox Church, from here out I will refer to it as the AOC or just the Church, is a non-canonical, primarily African-American denomination in the highest church Anglican tradition. The African Orthodox Church holds to the historic threefold ministry of bishops, priests, and deacons, and lays strong emphasis on apostolic succession. The church celebrates the seven sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church. Its worship is liturgical and blends elements of Eastern and Western rites. The Nicene, Apostles, and Athanasian creeds are affirmed as well. If you don't know what those things mean, please look them up. We don't really have the time in this podcast to go through them all. I know I said that this will be a shorter episode, but the religious terms I will leave to you to do your research. I'll say those again. The Nicene, Apostles, and Athanasian creeds are affirmed. Look them up if you get time. McGuire's search from Black equality led him to Marcus Garvey and to Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. Now, as you may recall, it is also known as the UNIA. So if I have to say it again, that's what I refer to it as, is the UNIA. Now, Garvey supported McGuire's notion of a Black denomination. And once McGuire founded the AOC, Garvey used his periodical entitled The Negro World to disseminate the news throughout Africa. We'll touch a little bit more on the connection between Garvey and McGuire in just a second, but we're going to get back to the church real quick. So first, the church was an expression of Black cultural independence in the United States and in Africa. It was an effort to promote widespread religious unity under Black leadership. The AOC's inclusion within the apostolic succession hoped to give it legitimacy in the eyes of both the Black community and the Christian world. This legitimacy, however, did not lead to the growth that McGuire had hoped for. Although the church increased in size during its first decade, it was primarily through the forceful personality of its leader rather than because of the principle of apostolic succession. Now, after his death, which we haven't gotten there yet, the church did splinter and weaken. In South Africa, however, there was growth, but not at the rate anticipated by Daniel William Alexander, whose most fruitful efforts were the spread of the church to Uganda and Kenya, now under the umbrella of the Orthodox Patriarchy of Alexandria. That's another name where that church falls under now. so second. In its attempt to bring together blacks of the diaspora in Africa into a common movement, the church was a manifestation of pro-Africanism. Pro-Pan-Africanism, excuse me. Spiritual and emotional needs left unattended in their respective countries really propelled blacks in the United States and South Africa to affiliate and assert their autonomy in an area where the white establishment saw no threat. Now, I want you to also remember here that if you've been listening to our series all along, then you should remember that around this time in South Africa, we had the first little vestiges of apartheid. Sorry, I drew a complete blank right there. We had the first vestiges of apartheid. So really in the 1920s, when we have Reconstruction along with apartheid going on in South Africa, you really got to remember that those of the diaspora in both South Africa and the United States really are fighting the same beast, just on two different continents. So it's very interesting that these two churches would pop up with the same goals, trying to fight the same things in both two contexts, a religious context, but then also in a social context where they can kind of operate without the constraints of the really fear that the white society was putting on them. Very different and a little, it's interesting in the course of history to see these two movements move together in kind of in an autonomous fashion. So discrimination, racism, and second-class citizenship endangered this effort at an ecclesiastical independence and racial cooperation on both sides of the Atlantic, like we just discussed. Article 1 of the Constitution of the AOC explicitly confirmed and endorsed the church's twofold understanding of itself and its mandate. And Article 1 of that constitution states,
"The name of this church, which was organized September 2nd, 1921, is and shall be the African Orthodox Church. Its faith, as declared, is orthodox, in conformity with the Orthodox Churches of the East, from which its episcopate is derived. While it admits to membership and other privileges persons of all races, it seeks particularly to reach out to the millions of African descent in both hemispheres and declares itself to be perpetually autonomous and controlled by Negroes, hence the name African Orthodox."
Now we're seeing here that we'll have to jump back just a little bit to touch on some of the connections between McGuire and Garvey, as we went forward in the timeline. So we'll have to jump backwards just a little bit, but it'll all flow together. So if you'll just bear with us a little bit. Now, if you see from the way the Constitution of the Church is written, he's clearly directly attacking the issues that they had with the Episcopal Church. Obviously they're saying we will be governed by Negroes. Although we will be inclusive of all races, we are primarily for the purpose of uplifting the Negro race. Now, as we discussed before, McGuire actually returned to Antigua in 1913, and that was primarily probably for the purpose of caring for his sick mother. But while he was there, he did volunteer for a time at the local parish and see that it was in just complete disarray. He also had the ability to put his doctoring skills to use, as again, he was a medical doctor earning that degree while he was in Boston. And he actually gained great acclaim across the island for practicing medicine while he was there. Now, this is where the connection to Garvey kind of comes up and really kind of that inspirational activism as well. While he was in Antigua, there was actually a strike of local sugarcane workers. Now, this activity of the strike actually led to riots and the workers burning the sugarcane fields in protest. Now, at the time, I want you to recall, Antigua was still a colony of Britain, and colonial officials were trying their best to urge, local officials and really religious leaders to oppose the strikes and hopefully quell kind of the issues that were going on. But McGuire refused, and he actually urged the colonial officials to provide the workers with decent living wages, something that seems like it seems like we continually fight this battle all the time between those in power and those with money and the working class. We see it in the United States now. Now, I think it's very interesting to note here that it seems like many prolific figures in the diaspora are really getting and coming to prominence and finding their activist voices really on the backs of social and political uprisings and riots that really have the polarizing effect of separating the mass populace from imperial and colonial rulers. Now, if you've been keeping up with our episodes thus far, we've seen this path to prominence come from Garvey, We've seen this path to prominence come from Stephen Biko, and now we're seeing it with Maguire. And taking this out of the diaspora for a second, the course of history has really shown that the same thing to be true in the cases of Che Guevara, Cesar Chavez, and really in San Francisco, even Harvey Milk. You know, this really makes me start to wonder, at least, and you know, I would love to get your feedback on this, if we'll see this in the same kind of activist to social movement on the backs of the Black Lives Matter movement and the prominent figures of the movement, such as, you know, I'll throw one name out there, D. Ray McKesson. You know, he's really been prominent. He's been kind of the face of the movement to a certain degree. There are some women that are the faces as well. And so I really wonder if we'll see this same kind of history really repeating itself. Now, following the strike in Antigua, Maguire actually returned to the United States in 1918, and he soon after joined the UNIA. As with his move to Boston, his reputation preceded him, and Marcus Garvey and the then UNIA president appointed him as chaplain general of the organization. Now, Maguire took no shame in declaring to his followers in the church, as well as the UNIA, quote, "You must forget the white gods. Erase the white gods from your hearts. We must go back to the native church, to our own true God," end quote. Now, this is actually where our title for the episode comes from, God and Christ Are Black. When Garvey decided in 1924 to relocate the UNIA headquarters to the West Indies, Maguire actually decided to leave the UNIA and instead devote himself to the expansion of his own church. Idnick Theological Seminary was founded shortly thereafter, as well as an Order of Deaconesses. A church magazine called The Negro Churchman also began publication, with Maguire being its editor. The rituals and beliefs which constituted Garveyism as an almost religious movement have really been described in some detail in prior episodes, and I encourage you to go back and listen to the Garvey episodes if you haven't before. But it remains to be seen really how these rituals and beliefs were finally given acceptable organizational expression. The problem was a difficult one, and really given the importance of the black churches to the work of the UNIA, and a workable solution emerged only really after considerable controversy among the UNIA leadership. Principal in this debate were actually Garvey and, of course, his foremost colleague in the Association, Maguire. While Garvey may have been one of the earliest black public figures to use the term, quote, Uncle Tom, Maguire was actually no stranger to it himself, and he really wasn't afraid to take his own position during the UNIA convention in 1920. Quote, "The Uncle Tom nigger has got to go, and his place must be taken by the new leader of the Negro race. Not a black man with a white heart, but a black man with a black heart," end quote. Now, Maguire was prominent among the theologians with whom Garvey had put to work in rewriting theology for the UNIA. And although there's been some confusion and misunderstanding as to the precise relationship between his African Orthodox Church and the UNIA, Maguire has generally been recognized as a central figure in UNIA leadership. In his first year as Chaplain General, Maguire produced for the UNIA the Universal Negro Ritual and the Universal Negro Catechism. Now, it wasn't widely known, but between late 1921 and mid-1923, Garvey and Maguire actually were in open conflict with one another, and to the point that Maguire was actually read out of the UNIA and was denounced as a traitor. Now, right here, I know it may seem a little bit contradictory to mention that Garvey decided to move the headquarters to the West Indies, and it was at this same time Maguire decided to break apart from the UNIA, and then to mention in almost the same breath that there was a heavy rift in the relationship between the two men, which led Garvey to denouncing that Maguire was a traitor. But then there isn't really a ton that's on the record to what led to the breakdown of the relationship. I mean, I can guess it was kind of a good thing that, you know, what was going wrong in the house kind of stayed in the house, but for our purposes, and really for the historical record, I do kind of wish that there was more to tell you regarding this connection between the two and really the ultimate breakdown. But shortly after the UNIA convention in August of 1924, like I said, Maguire broke with Garvey and actually focused on expanding his own church, which attracted mostly Anglican West Indian immigrants, in addition to the other ventures, you know, before the magazine that he had and the Order of the Deaconesses. Now, Maguire founded a parish of his denomination in West Palm Beach, Florida in 1925. And 2 years after that was the time he worked with the South African African Orthodox Church and consecrated an African clergy as Metropolitan Archbishop Archbishop for South Africa and Central and Southern Africa. Well, we've mentioned this name before, but once again, his name was William Daniel Alexander. At the same time, McGuire was elected Patriarch of the denomination with the title of Alexander I. During this time, the church was then spread to Uganda as well. Now, I know prior I mentioned to not confuse the two churches, but the reason was because I wanted you to keep them separate until the end, which is almost where we're at now, when we could properly fuse the two together. And from all we could gather, the two churches were founded at different times, but the reputation and prior experience of McGuire actually lended itself really, really well to the spread of the South African sect of the church, especially as the reach of Garvey really gave a great bit of credence to the efforts and motive of McGuire. Like I said, the rift between them kind of stayed in house, so Garvey declaring McGuire to be a traitor almost kind of didn't spread itself across seas. On November 8th, 1931, McGuire actually dedicated Holy Cross Pro Cathedral in New York City. Unfortunately, McGuire died on November 10th, almost 3 years to the date of this dedication in 1934. He is currently buried in Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx, New York City. He was survived by his wife, Ada Robert McGuire, also a native of Antigua, and one daughter. At the time of his death, the African Orthodox Church had about 30,000 members and about 50 clergy in about 30 parishes across the United States, Africa, Cuba, Antigua, and Venezuela. George Alexander McGuire was canonized by the African Orthodox Church on July 31st, 1983, and is considered to be a saint of the church. At the time of his death in 1934, the African Orthodox Church was claiming again over 30,000 members, 50 clergy, and 30 churches on three continents. It's a pretty good spread considering that he was the very first person. Now, as we've reached the end of this episode, I do have a couple favorite quotes from McGuire that I'd like to share with you all. And really, since this is the platform and occasion to do it, I guess I'll share it here with you. And I want you to kind of remember these, especially in relation to his founding of the African Orthodox Church, its mission, its values, and then its spread to Africa, and also, you know, his connection with the UNIA and his role there. "Let us start our Negro painters getting busy and supply a Black Madonna and a Black Christ for the training of our children." You know, one of the issues that I think numerous people, especially across the diaspora, have always had with religion and the church is that the images that we look up to aren't quite the images of ourselves. You know, we always see the images of white Jesus, or some people have said it could be Caesar Borgia. I'll let you look up that name on your own. That name is Caesar Borgia. And so, you know, McGuire starting his own church and then proclaiming for us to, you know, paint our own Black Madonna and paint a Black Christ for the training of our children, I think that's pretty prolific. And again, as a matter of fact, there's actually another quote as well that McGuire stated during a rally of the UNIA when he was obviously still affiliated with Garvey that I'd like to share with you too. Quote, "If the white man is going to impress on the children of my race that everything good is white and that everything that is of the devil is black, then let us here at this convention begin to rewrite theology." You know, that's the same thing as well. You know, we always see pure and white as snow, and, you know, there's just a lot of negative images that are proclaimed, with positive things being considered white, negative things being considered black. We really have to kind of rewrite that, especially in the mind of ourselves, but more importantly, in the minds of our children and the next generation. You know, the thought of devil's food cake being black, angel food cake being white, it's just the tip of the iceberg, but it gets to us at almost a granular level, and a subconscious level at that. So while, again, I'll say this all the time, we won't generally do episodes on religion, the impact and the message that George Alexander McGuire spread and championed was really an all-important one. While religion continues to be a vestige and really important aspect and heavy influence of and on Black culture, this episode I feel like was a very important one for us to do here. While we're able to see the disparity of treatment firsthand, McGuire, you know, he decided to take two routes that we very greatly admire here at the Black History Podcast. First, he made his demands known and that there was a need for separation in the religious sect. But then when that didn't come to fruition, he realized that the only way to progress in the necessary ways was a complete separation that would include him and his followers in believing having their own. You know, and then not stopping there, McGuire was able to spread and unify with the African church that believed the same as himself and really sought to spread the same message across the African continent. Now, again, we won't be able to touch to the issues of Garvey and Maguire's personal relationships and business ones as well. You know, can and do go south, even with the best of intentions. But the kind of diasporic unification efforts of the two, especially as, you know, if you really think about it, in his religious movement, Maguire needed the political arm. And because of the influence of religion, Garvey needed the religious one. You know, that kind of unification is very admirable to this day. Quite often we see, you know, kind of, and just call a spade, quite often we see the attention-starved leaders within our community refusing to put their quest for the spotlight aside, and, you know, they would rather instead fracture movement efforts. But not these two. You know, they were able to work together for strategic aims. And even though it didn't work out in the end, you know, with Garvey obviously declaring him to be a traitor, you know, the attempt was made, and they made a strong effort to make it work. You know, they took their strengths, and I do believe that they were able to bring together their two groups, you know, because they had very similar direct goals and aims. Now, I'd really hate to be cliche here, but, you know, the course of history is steadily teaching us that the closed fist is much mightier than the spread fingers of the hand. Now, that being said, in closing, please be sure to check us out every week for new and updated topics. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode or any others, please feel free to visit our website at www.blackhistorypodcast.com or www.thisiscarrington.com/podcast, or just navigate to the podcast tab at the top. Now, as we develop and grow, you will find an archive of each episode, plans for future episodes, as well as additional links to books and resources that will help you on your journey to self-enlightenment. Now, we encourage you to share episodes with your friends and everyone that you know. You know, our history is important. It's been glossed over, whitewashed, and just completely disregarded far too often. And that's what our purpose here is here at the Black History Podcast, is to teach you our history so that you'll know and so that you'll have that sense of self. Send us your feedback as well. Suggest new topics, events, or people we should cover. Or if you just wish to drop us a line and give us your thoughts or perspectives to an episode we've done, we'll make every best effort to include listener mail or commentary to future episodes. As we take this journey together, please, we will do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light, with some occasional commentary presented, obviously, just like this episode, less so in religious episodes that we'll do. But if you see any errors or mistakes in anything that we've done, our research, our commentary, anything, please let us know. Because as we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care, and we'll see you next week.